You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, Wisconsin health records say 11,000 children in Milwaukee are unvaccinated and at risk of contracting measles or other diseases. We discuss the national outbreak and whether the disease is here to stay. First, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. This week, we're taking a look at two major utility developments happening on opposite ends of the state. We start in northern Wisconsin, where a subsidiary of the Xcel Energy Company has applied to the state's Public Service Commission to build a new transmission line along the Bayfield Peninsula. Danielle Kading is a WPR News reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Judith.
Xcel Energy already provides power for 75% of customers on the Bayfield Peninsula, and now the company is applying to build a new transmission line. Why is Xcel saying that it's necessary?
Well, it's because the line or parts of the line are more than 50 years old. So the utility wants to upgrade power in the area to, well, basically strengthen power and reliability because they've had problems with outages in the area as well as voltage issues because there have been more people that have been added to the line or at least the load on the line has increased in cities like Bayfield and Washburn over the years. So really it can't handle what it's seen at this point in time.
My understanding is that there are two proposed routes for this line. What are officials considering as they decide which route to ultimately construct?
Well, they're considering a number of things. One, they want to minimize the environmental impacts to the area. And when I say they, I mean the five towns and the two cities that would be affected by this project. You know, it's a very scenic area, and so they want to maintain that character of the Bayfield Peninsula. And they figure by doing that that it's probably a better idea to follow the existing route of that transmission line. So there's been a project that's been proposed, or I guess a route that's been proposed on the eastern side of the peninsula that would follow the existing line that is already there. And then there's another western route that would cut through areas of the Bayfield County Forest and affect more land than has been previously.
So that's the environmental side. Are there other concerns for landowners who may be living or have a business near one of these routes?
Yeah, these routes have different impacts. Xcel says there's pros and cons to both of them. For landowners, there would be more homeowners that would be, or more landowners that would be affected by the west route, which does not follow the existing line. And it would also require more trees to be cleared to build that route. Along the eastern route, Xcel says that that might make it more vulnerable to provide reliable power to the area in the event of severe weather, and where they feel that going along the west route might provide more reliability because then you'd have them geographically and physically separated if you had one line going around the eastern side of the peninsula and then following this other western route. But the company has also said that they are not favoring or preferring any route at this time, and they proposed a second route in response to community concerns.
And Danny, what is the timeline for first the decision on which route will be used and then for the actual construction?
Well, Xcel just, or Northern States Power, a company owned by Xcel, had just filed the application this spring. So right now it's going through the permitting process with the Public Service Commission. Xcel is hoping that they can begin construction next year with a goal of having the line in service by the end of 2021.
Well, Danny, thanks so much for keeping us up to date.
Thanks, Judith.
Now we head to the southwest part of the state, where dozens of new cell phone towers are expected to be built this year by communications company Bug Tussle. The scope of the project has some residents raising objections. Gillian Pomplin is a reporter with the Crawford County Independent. Gillian, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much.
Can you give us a sense of what this company, Bug Tussle, is building and planning in counties in southwestern Wisconsin?
Yes, it seems that they are trying to create a data pathway that sort of runs through Iowa, Richland, Vernon, Monroe, and La Crosse counties. I'm aware that they've also built towers in Lafayette County.
And you reported on some of the questions and concerns that people in those counties are asking about all these new potential cell phone towers going up. What are some of the specific concerns you're hearing from residents?
Well, you know, a lot of the local opposition has bubbled up in the media, now in our newspaper, but also in the newspapers, the Episcope in Lafarge and the Epitaph in Biola. They're really questioning, you know, the need for these cell phone towers. All of the permits that Bug Tussle, which is based in Green Bay, are filing are sort of boilerplate or rubber stamp. They all land in the county's zoning and sanitation offices and state that their proposed sites will have AT&T mobile voice and internet and Bug Tussle fixed internet services. The local residents in West Lima, in particular, have expressed that they feel very well served with the fiber optic cable that has been delivered to essentially to the front door of every resident in Vernon and in this part of Richland County from Vernon Telephone Cooperative. We in the area serviced by the Richland Grant Telephone Cooperative have marvelous, fiber optic cable internet delivered to us from the Richland Grant Cooperative. It's about $75 a month to obtain, you know, that kind of service in, you know, what is typically referred to as a high cost, which is to say rural area where, you know, the population densities dictate that these companies who may want to come in and provide these services will have a hard time getting a return on investment for, you know, the amount of cost of putting in the infrastructure. So we're very fortunate in these rural areas. We also have adequate cell phone service. And so a lot of the local counties are and residents are saying, gee, why are you providing us something we essentially don't need?
And do the residents feel like they had ample advance information, or is there any sense of this kind of having come up unexpectedly?
Well, I think the some of the counties, particularly Iowa County and La Crosse County, have been seeing these applications coming from front of the zoning and sanitation departments for a number of years ramping up to this. Monroe County says that, you know, they were getting these permit applications in 2017, 2018, and now continuing into 2019. So I think it's more a situation of local residents becoming aware of these towers, the number of them, and the fact that, you know, they're essentially going to be sited in some cases right in their backyard.
Gillian, due to changes in state law, it sounds like county and town governments don't have a lot of say in whether or not these towers get built. Can you talk about the position that those municipalities are in?
Well, after the Wisconsin legislature passed what is known as Act 20, which was, you know, I'm not an expert on state government, but I think it's, you know, sort of a budget omnibus bill where a lot, you know, there's a budget that gets passed, but then they will tack on a whole bunch of extra things that don't, you know, really seem related. And in 2012, the legislature passed Act 20, which essentially removed local control, or as it was more traditionally known, especially out here in rural areas, home rule from municipalities, which includes counties, villages, townships. They have no say in these siting decisions about where the towers are put or if they will be made. So You know, there's a lot of sort of homegrown resentment to that. There's also a feeling, I think, of frustration on the part of the counties in particular where these permits are landing that, you know, they basically have no say in any of these decisions.
And Gillian, briefly, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next as this develops?
Well, I think, you know, there's been a group that's been organized now in sort of headquartered in West Lima, which is, I don't know, a population of 20 or something, you know, people for sane technology. And so they are, you know, organizing to educate local residents about how this is a local control issue, how it's actually a landowner's right issue, because they say that property values in the proximity of these cell towers can plummet as much as 20%. They're also concerned that these towers could be, as the CFO of AT&T recently essentially explained at some conference in Europe sponsored by Deutsche Bank, it's sort of the AT&T's stepping stone to 5G through this national contract they've gotten to create this first net. So they're concerned about the health effects of 5G if that is in fact, you know, where this is going.
Well, Gillian, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet.
Gillian Pomplin is a reporter for the Crawford County Independent. She was with us to talk about dozens of new cell phone towers being constructed in southwestern Wisconsin and to wrap up our weekly look at news from around the state. Measles continues to infect people across the United States. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there have been 764 cases in 23 states this year alone. More than half of them are in New York City. No cases have been reported in Wisconsin to date. But state health records show that more than 11,000 students in Milwaukee Public Schools alone are not fully vaccinated against measles and other diseases this school year, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And across Wisconsin, about 15% of residents haven't received the full MMR vaccine, according to the State Department of Health Services. Measles was declared eliminated in the U.S. by the Pan American Health Organization in the year 2000. But our guest says that the U.S. could soon lose that status if the number of cases continues to rise. Renee Nahara is an epidemiologist and associate scientist at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the editor of the vaccine website, The History of Vaccines, an educational resource from the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Dr. Nahara, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So why this sudden surge in measles? Do we know how it started?
Yeah, so it's a combination of several factors. Number one, vaccine hesitancy has really peaked in the United States. Now more than ever, there are parents who are concerned about the alleged side effects of vaccination, and they stayed away from vaccinating their children. This information has been going around on social media for some years, but now it's reached a peak. Number two, there's measles everywhere in the world right now for different reasons. So, for example, in Venezuela, it's because the public health system has collapsed due to the civil unrest. In Madagascar, there's a very big epidemic with several thousand children dying there because the vaccine is unattainable. In Europe, there's a combination of vaccine hesitancy and decreased access to the vaccine as well. And so people have traveled from the United States. People who are not vaccinated have traveled from the United States and brought it back to their communities where there are concentrated numbers of children in particular who are not vaccinated, and they brought it back. And now it's spreading in those communities. And even as we found out recently from New York City, it's now getting into outside of those communities as well.
So what exactly is the measles? I think most of us know to think of that red rash, but really what is it and what kind of damage does it cause to someone?
It's a respiratory infection. So you transmit it through the air. Somebody who is infectious a couple of days after being infected, and certainly before some of the first symptoms, they sneeze or they cough and the measles virus floats in the air and then somebody else picks it up. The virus enters through the respiratory system into the body, through your lungs, your throat, your nose, into the body, and then it spreads throughout the body, and it affects the bone marrow, and it reproduces there as well. So, you know, if for the vast majority of people, it's not a complicated disease. If by complicated, you know, we mean like a high chance of death. It's not that. However, it does cause fever, body aches, pain, and in about 1 in 1,000 cases, death. In about 1 in 1,000 cases, encephalitis, which is a swelling of the brain. And then there's other complications such as ear infections, pneumonia, et cetera. And so when there used to be plenty of measles in the U.S., I'm talking before the vaccine era in the 40s, 50s, you'd have upwards of 500,000 people, mostly children, coming down with it. And then within those, you'd have hundreds of deaths. And once the vaccine came on board and people adopted it widely, those numbers of cases dropped to just a few hundred a year. And the number of deaths really hasn't been there, mostly because of the effect of the vaccine.
We're talking with Rene Nahara. He's an epidemiologist and associate scientist at Johns Hopkins University. We are talking about whether the measles are back for good. And Dr. Nahara, one of the things that we talked about is that 15% of Wisconsin residents have not received the full vaccine. What is the course of vaccination to make sure that we are protected against the measles?
In the United States, the recommendation is to vaccinate around 12 to 15 months of age. So a child 1 year of age, you know, usually goes in for their checkup and they get it then. And then one more time before elementary school or in the first year of elementary school, because it's usually a requirement for schools in most of the states in the United States. And there is no requirement for the vaccine further on in life, although that is being discussed now in light of the situation with measles. And to a certain extent, the MMR vaccine, the second M in the MMR is mumps. And so we've seen a resurgence of mumps as well in people who are vaccinated. And that's probably because they are no longer boosted. And what I mean by boosted is that they because the vaccine has been working so well, you don't get exposed to people with mumps anymore. And so your immunity wanes after a while from not being exposed to people in the community with it. And so there is some discussion that there might be a recommendation coming down the line for a third MMR right after high school and before entering college.
So as we said, Wisconsin has not had a confirmed reported case of measles in this outbreak. But is it pretty much just a matter of time? Are we bound to see it here?
Well, it depends. It depends on where those 15% are spread out. If they're highly concentrated in one community or in one area, then yeah, you have a very high chance of seeing it. Because the measles is incredibly infectious. It is one of the most infectious viruses out there. It's even more infectious than influenza and Ebola. Somebody with influenza, they infect one or two people on average, you know, just walking around. Somebody with Ebola infects about one other person. Well, the measles infects 18 people. So one person is capable of infecting up to 18 people. That just tells you how infectious it is. And because it is that infectious, we need about 93 to 95, it would be better if it were higher than that, but between 93 and 95% of a population to be immunized. So that community immunity kicks in, and the people who are not able to get immunized because they're either too young, you know, children under 1 year of age, or too sick to be immunized, cancer patients, people with advanced HIV/AIDS, they will be protected by other people being immunized around them. And so when you talk about the 15%, the question there is, where are they? Are they concentrated in one community, or are they spread out enough that the community immunity from other people getting the vaccine is protecting them as well? And so, you know, that's kind of something that would need to be looked at in much more detail.
The measles outbreak has health officials at the University of Wisconsin-Madison thinking about requiring students to get the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, that MMR that you mentioned. Right now, UW says that it's just recommended. Most of the other Big Ten schools do require it, with the exceptions of opting out due to religious beliefs or medical reasons. What advice would you as an epidemiologist give to the decision makers at UW?
Well, the vaccine has an excellent safety record. A lot of the concerns about the MMR vaccine causing autism, that is no longer a concern as far as science goes. The science has been settled on that. As far as any of the secondary side effects of the vaccine, they've been disproven. The vaccine has been around since the 1960s. So we're going on 50 plus years of evidence that, you know, billions of people have received it. And really, we haven't seen anything bad from it. So the recommendation would be that if you have a population at your university or your school that is under immunized, then it would be a good public health practice to encourage them to be caught up, not only for themselves, but again, for those people around them that are not able to get vaccinated because of medical reasons, and so that they protect their community as well. That said, you know, it's easier said than done because we have, unfortunately, a cultural debate on the issue of immunizations. But I am encouraging that a lot of young people seem to be doing proper research with accredited sources on the internet and coming to the decision of getting caught up on their immunizations when their parents chose not to immunize them.
What if someone really doesn't know what their immunization record is for whatever reason? What's the best course of action then?
It would be to talk to their healthcare provider. Their physician would be the best person to advise them on whether or not to get caught up all over again with the immunization schedule. It varies on a case-by-case basis. Most of us, you know, we know what our immunization status is because it was required for school and our schools kept a vaccination record. Other people, I understand, they travel and they don't keep their records with them. And so then that would be a conversation to have with a physician of saying, look, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is where I live. Would it make sense for me to get caught up with my immunizations to lower my risk of these diseases?
And very briefly, do you expect this outbreak to get worse before it gets better?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. Like I said, the measles is very infectious. One person can infect up to 18 other people. There is a lot of pockets of vaccine hesitancy around the entire country that where we haven't seen the measles yet. And so I'm pretty sure that it's going to be coming to them. So, yeah, we're going to see. It's a record-breaking year already. We haven't seen this much measles in 25-plus years. So it's gonna be a little bit worse. But hopefully public health response is robust enough and people do come to their senses when it comes to immunization and they take us up on our recommendations that are based on evidence and on science.
Well, Dr. Nahara, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Dr. Renee Nahara is an epidemiologist and associate scientist at Johns Hopkins University. We talked with him about the current measles outbreak in the U.S., which, according to the CDC, stands at 764 cases in 23 states. The Vatican announced new rules yesterday that are being called its most comprehensive approach to the clergy sex abuse crisis since allegations started to surface decades ago. The rules would require officials in the church to report sexual abuse and any attempts to cover up abuse. But many survivors are saying it's still not enough, pointing to the fact that the new law doesn't require that law enforcement be notified of an allegation and that it doesn't say anything about how an official who is a perpetrator of sexual abuse should be punished. Emma Green covers religion, policy, and politics at The Atlantic. Emma, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So these new rules go into effect next month, but as it stands right now, it seems like the rules about reporting are kind of a patchwork around the world. Is that correct?
That's right. In the United States, the bishops put in place measures right after that notorious scandal in Boston in 2001 and 2002, mandating reporting across the diocese in the United States. But the problem in the U.S., and especially in other countries around the world, is that there was never a central policy coming from the very top level of the church, from the Pope himself, that set standards, making it obligatory for all leaders of the church, from the lowest priest to the highest bishop, to report and be held accountable for their actions.
Well, let's dig into what these new rules would do. First of all, you said from you know, the parish level priest up to a bishop, a cardinal, the Pope himself, I'm assuming. What about other religious, for instance, nuns or maybe brothers?
So these rules are expansive both in the imagination of who should be held accountable for reporting and also who can be identified as a victim. And I think this is important in part because the thing we have learned over the past few years is that the sexual abuse scandal is not just about the abuse of children. It's about the use of abuse of authority and the pressuring of people across the church, from seminarians to women religious and nuns, into these kinds of sexual acts that has left all of them victimized and without any kind of recourse. So it does have that kind of expansiveness, both in terms of responsibility, but also in trying to make that reparation for those people who are attacked.
So one of the things that I found interesting about this is that it is not just saying you as an official of the Catholic Church, and again, just to distinguish from a member, for instance, you as an official of the Catholic Church, it's not just if you know of abuse that is happening. It's if you know of attempts to cover up abuse. So you might not have firsthand knowledge of the abuse itself, but you know of the cover up. And that, too, is now mandated to be reported.
That's right. One of the most remarkable things about this new law is that it not only puts in place a standard for those bishops, those top level church leaders, for investigating and reporting these allegations, it also creates a mechanism to actually trigger an investigation of bishops if they fail to do that. So you yourself as a church leader can be held accountable for the failure to follow these laws and take seriously this obligation for reporting that is being set forth by the Pope.
And do these new rules, this new law, start next month and move forward, or is this also retroactive?
So these are experimental, meaning they're set in place for 3 years. The Pope has signaled his intention to maybe reevaluate after that 3-year period. And it does not cover the crimes of the past. This is about trying to create accountability mechanisms moving forward to put in place those formal structures in the church that will make sure that bishops cannot get away with moving priests around from parish to parish, for example. And I think that's one of the greatest gaps here and something that the church might not be able to fix. It has done all of this harm and has mishandled so many allegations in the past. And this does not really do anything to fix that. All it does is promise that maybe in the future, the church will be able to handle and process these allegations in a better way.
So there is now mandatory reporting for many, many people to be mandatory reporters. How are they supposed to do that? What are the mechanisms or the structure that is in place or will be for them to report?
So this lays out a structure requiring everyone from that local parish priest all the way up to the bishop to report. And it offers language that says basically those people are supposed to identify the proper authority. In the case of the parish priest, that would be your local bishop who's the head of your diocese. But even going all the way up to those bishops, there's now a structure in place that refers to these metropolitans or these kind of regional leaders who are real powerful cardinals or bishops who can oversee a geographic area. And those people now have new responsibilities for making sure that all of the bishops in their region are also cooperating and following these rules.
So as you said, Emma, a lot of this has been about abuse of power. And of course, when you are on the maybe the lowest or one of the low rungs in a huge hierarchy like the church is, there can be a lot of concern about what kind of retribution there might be against you if you report. What, if any, protections are in place for people who come forward and follow this new law that says they have to report?
This is explicitly protecting those people who might refer to themselves as whistleblowers, both in terms of reporting allegations against priests or bishops, but also against people who follow up on those investigations that led nowhere or the allegations that turned up nothing. This is a clear statement from the Pope that the position of the Vatican is that it is not only important to report, but the Vatican is on the side of the people who tell the truth. And that is such an important culture shift from where the church has been even 10 or 20 years ago. This culture of cover up and concealment has been so pernicious and pervasive throughout the global church. And this is a real mark of a changed moment for the attitude of the church in terms of transparency.
We're talking with Emma Green. She covers religion, policy, and politics at The Atlantic. We're talking about a new church law that came out of the Vatican yesterday that makes all officials of the Catholic Church mandated reporters of sexual abuse, not just of children, but also of adults as well. Now, this has been an issue, as you said. Well, it's been an issue for much longer than it's been really publicly known. But there has always been a hesitance or a sense against mandating that those in the church who know of abuse report to civil authorities, not just to church authorities. Why is there such resistance to that?
I think in the early days of this scandal, especially in the United States, there was a sense of ignorance and naivete among church leaders who believed that they could handle these kinds of allegations internally. They knew what to do to, quote unquote, fix the priests, and they had basically, above all, the well-being of the priest and the well-being of the church in mind. Now, this new law changes that in certain ways, in the sense that it makes mandatory the sharing of information with victims. It acknowledges that there may be local laws in some of these countries that mandate those reports to outside authorities. But I think there will be a lot of criticism, and I've already heard some of this from survivors, that this law does not have any requirement that the church stop policing itself, that it turn outside of itself, it hands over the documents and hands over the cases and says somebody outside of the church, some law enforcement body that's run by a government, is going to be able to do a better job of policing the church. And I think that's a real point of sensitivity for survivors who don't think that the church is a good faith player on these issues.
Mari Collins is a survivor of priest sex abuse, and she shared her reaction to the new law with NPR's Morning Edition today. Here's some of what she had to say.
It doesn't change anything as far as reporting to civil authorities. It's not even a word of encouragement to go and report to the state authorities. Yes, the whole document about how important reporting is internally, but nothing about externally. And that is where, to me, the document completely falls down.
Emma, does that echo what other survivors are coming forward and saying?
Absolutely. And this is something, when I was reporting in Boston earlier this year about the legacy of the sexual abuse scandal there, this was something I heard from so many advocates and survivors, that it was important for the church, when it gets these allegations, to turn over those documents and give law enforcement authorities the ability to actually hold the church accountable from the outside. I do know that from a global perspective, there were some church leaders from countries in the global south where the governments are more hostile to Catholicism. They worried that having that mandatory reporting to civil authorities could potentially create an excuse for the government to try to curtail church activities or to crack down on Catholicism. So there were some nuances there, I think, that the Pope was balancing and trying to reach the global church. But I do know that the survivor perspective that Marie Collins shared there is one that's shared widely among people who don't trust the church to be able to police itself.
We're talking with Emma Green right now. She's from The Atlantic, and we're talking about new rules coming out of the Vatican this week dealing with clergy sexual abuse. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that these new rules are a sign of progress, especially if you are a survivor of clergy sexual abuse or a Catholic yourself? Do you think these rules do enough to stop the abuse in the Catholic Church? Are you skeptical about whether the Church will be able to police itself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time after this short break. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Emma Green of The Atlantic about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and a new law announced by the Vatican yesterday that, among other things, requires church officials to report sexual abuse and attempts to cover it up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way the Catholic Church has responded to this issue? Has the Church's handling of it changed the way you think about your faith, or is that separate from the Church? And what questions do you have about how this new law will work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. And let's go to the phones, and Mary in Whitewater is up. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was telling the screener that I work in healthcare, and I'm obligated by law to report child sex abuse and physical abuse, and I think that should apply to the Catholic Church. At least we're required by law in the state. So that's my thoughts, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Great. Thanks for that comment, Mary. And Emma?
So it is true that in the United States, there are rules around the obligations of religious figures to report not only allegations of abuse, but lots of other types of things that could potentially endanger people. And what this law does and does not do, it does, on the one hand, make it clear that inside the church around the world, there are uniform rules, but it does not say that in places around the world where there aren't those rules, there aren't those protections that are put in place by state governments or the federal government, like in the U.S., that priests and bishops still have to report to civil authorities. So it's that patchwork effect that I think survivors are really reacting to when they are thinking about that lack of reporting to civil authorities.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mike in Madison is up. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an ex-Catholic my principal tried to molest me from a Catholic school a couple times. And no, the law does not go far enough. The law does not go far enough. You molest a child, you go to jail. If you know about it, you turn a person in, you let the authorities investigate this. And it's not just the Catholic Church. It's people in the God business all over the world. Whether it's a youth pastor, whether it's a minister, they are getting away with molesting and raping our children.
Thanks for that call, Mike. And that's a really good comment, actually. This is certainly not exclusive to the Catholic Church. We just did a segment not too long ago about sexual abuse of children in the Boy Scouts. Other religious faiths have gone through similar crises. But this new law from the Vatican is the reason for the conversation today. Emma, we've heard from people who are saying, you know, this just isn't enough. And I think the undertone is, where's the real commitment on this issue?
I think that's right. And I'm so sorry to hear of the trauma that that listener went through. And I think that kind of pain is what really animates this conversation. You know, the vast majority of clerics who work in the Catholic Church don't abuse children, but that minority who do and who have also committed abuses against seminarians or nuns or all other types of people, those people create an enormous amount of pain and trauma, and they leave in their wake this sense of mistrust and deep, deep cynicism about the moral authority of the church. So I do think it's important, especially from that survivor perspective, to recognize that this is not just an internal matter, that these are crimes that people are committing, and they do need to be held accountable as such.
Emma, one thing that the new law doesn't touch on is what happens to a priest who's been found to have engaged in sexual abuse. That seems like a kind of a major part of this that was left out.
It's right. There's been a lot of complaint that I've seen so far that there isn't a punishment structure attached to these new rules. It's not really clear what exactly happens when people don't follow these new measures laid out by the Pope. The Pope has put forth in recent months other measures that do have really concrete consequences attached. For example, at the end of March, he promulgated rules that said Vatican officials or diplomats who didn't report could face jail time. But this didn't have that, and I think that has left people with a deep sense of dissatisfaction.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mark in Milwaukee is up. Hello, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
I'm a lifelong Catholic, and first off, this crisis, which it is, hasn't affected my faith because I believe in God, not in other people, you know, fellow Catholics, whether they're good or bad, they're still fellow Catholics, and everybody's got their own job to do. But I think the rules almost aren't even in the right direction of what should be done. I wish the church would take it upon itself to ordain godly men, because if the church is true to itself and it calls on priests to be true to the calling, child abuse is not a problem, for God's sakes, much less, you know, heavy drinking or other kinds of sin, because that's the whole point of the Catholic Church is to be godly.
Thanks for that call, Mark. So Mark really separating there his faith and the bad actions by those few, Emma.
That's something that I've heard from a number of Catholic faithful, that they feel that the message of the church, the teachings of the Bible, Jesus are not things that they're willing to give up on, despite the immense failings of the Catholic Church, which is a human institution. And I also have heard a lot from seminarians and people who work with young priests who are trying to discern a vocation in the church, exactly what that caller just spoke of, this sense that there's a need for the church to also look at who it is creating as priests, who it's giving power to, how they're being taught, and how they're being selected.
We're talking with Emma Green of The Atlantic about new rules from the Vatican that mandate reporting of sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. And interestingly, you know, we've been talking quite a bit, Emma, about the response from especially survivors who are saying this law does not go nearly far enough. On the other hand, Pope Francis has been in some conflict already with the much more conservative members of especially the hierarchy in the Catholic Church. What response are we getting from them?
You know, it's an interesting point because in my perspective, the responses really differ across the perspective of people who are sort of internal to the Catholic Church and people who are more external. So I've seen canon lawyers who you might call liberal or conservative, scholars who you might call liberal or conservative, who have applauded this and think that it's the right step forward for the church, who are acquainted with this difficulty around bishop accountability and think the Pope has made a great move. And then on the other side, I think people who are in the pews, people who are outside of the church, who are skeptical, who have lost faith, who have been abused by the church, those people who are more outsiders, I think their perspectives are much more skeptical. So I would actually make that divide around insider-outsider rather than necessarily around liberal and conservative.
Interesting. Emma, we saw a lot more people feeling comfortable and supported in coming out with stories of sexual harassment, sexual assault with the Me Too movement. Do things like this effort by the Vatican often bring forward more people who may have been sitting with these stories for years, decades even, and now feel maybe a little more comfortable sharing it?
Absolutely. One thing that we know, especially from the last couple of years with the Pennsylvania grand jury report that came out, the publication of lists by various dioceses of past abusers, the establishment of hotlines, all of these steps that have been taken, especially in the United States, what we know is that those open a floodgate. When people have a place to report, when they have a signal from the church and from law enforcement that they're going to be taken seriously, they come forward. And that's why this is such a moving and affecting and horrible, horrible scandal, because the truth is that we don't really know the scale of it yet. Really, it's only coming into focus now, many, many years after that first scandal broke in Boston, how extensive this is and really seeing how much more there might be that has not yet been reported.
And very briefly, Emma, what are you looking for as this rule takes effect next month?
I will be looking for the consistency across the world, how countries that have not been through the gauntlet on this issue will be implementing this and how they take it. And I also will be watching Pope Francis to see if this is the last we hear from him on sexual abuse and he washes his hands and thinks he's done enough and moves on, or whether this continues to be something that he speaks about and takes on from the top level of the church, because this is only the beginning of the church trying to solve and rectify this horrible, horrible sin and crime that's been perpetuated across generations.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Emma Green, a writer for The Atlantic who covers religion, policy, and politics. She was with us today to talk about rules announced by Pope Francis yesterday that would require officials in the Catholic Church to report sexual abuse and cover-ups. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, more than 1 million people lost health insurance coverage in 2018. We'll look at why that was the case and what it might mean moving forward.